We begin our exploration of authenticity with music, as correspondent Jeff London looks at how sound can be manipulated in digital recordings, and now in the concert hall as well.
Back in the 70s, there was a TV commercial for a certain brand of audio tape that showed Ella Fitzgerald in a recording studio singing away. The climax of the ad was a shot of a crystal water glass, which shattered as Ella hit a stratospherically high note. Then, a serious voice asked,
"Is it live? Or is it Memorex?"
Watching this commercial on a black and white TV with a lousy monaural speaker, the idea that any tape could sound as good as a real singer seemed fairly ludicrous. But not anymore. Current digital recording technology makes it almost impossible to tell what's real and what isn't. Recordings can be manipulated in the subtlest of ways with digital devices like pitch shifters, which correct out-of-tune notes. Let me demonstrate. Here I'm singing
la,
a bit flat. And presto, here's that same note,
la,
tuned to perfection by the pitch shifter. Digital reverb has gotten more sophisticated too. Okay, here I am in a small room, on a concert stage, and in a cathedral. And these are just a couple of tools that are in the arsenal of a contemporary CD producer like Thomas C. Shepard, who's recorded hundreds of classical and original Broadway cast recordings in his 40-year career. Shepard enthusiastically embraces today's technology, much of which was developed for pop music.
As multiple-track digital recording has become easier and easier, and as you have more control over the information, as it were, on each separate track, the more, during a recording session, one can concentrate on performance rather than on every possible refinement of sound, because you know you've got those sound elements kind of in the bag to play around with later.
Bit by bit, putting it together, piece by piece, only way to make a work of art.
The cast album of Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George, one of Thomas C. Shepard's first digital recordings. Shepard feels that a recording should be looked on as a document that stands on its own, rather than as a documentary of a single performance.
The bottom line is, you do whatever works to make it the best recording you can. I don't think it's a question of morality or cheating or anything else. There's the most beautiful thing in the Verdi Requiem. There's a Sanctus for a double chorus. And while that Sanctus is going on, there are the most wonderful allegro lines that are passing in the strings from highest to lowest. But these lines, they're so beautiful, and a recording can bring them out with a little bit more detail and clarity than you'll usually hear in the concert hall.
Most classical recordings are compiled from many individual takes, and sometimes performances are literally constructed phrase by phrase. The process can enhance a great performance, but it can also be used to mask a performer's inadequacies. New York Times music critic Anthony Tomasini says he would never base his estimation of a performer completely on a recording.
I mean, it's a pretty good indication, but you just don't really know until you hear somebody live, especially singers.
Tenor Andrea Bocelli is a contemporary superstar who sold millions of CDs. Anthony Tomasini saw him in a production of Massenet's Werther in Detroit in October 1999.
I mean, he has a vocal gift, there's some talent there, but there are very weak aspects to his singing. He had sung only in stadiums for thousands of people with very fancy amplification systems. So at the Opera House, I mean, that night it was filled with his fans. You could see them everywhere. And at intermission, you saw them in little support groups in the lobby, sort of shocked and talking to each other and trying to help each other to understand how their hero could have sounded so puny and weak.
There was no amplification in the opera house, and most critics agreed that Bocelli's voice wasn't large enough to fill the hall. While amplification is expected in stadiums and Broadway theaters, opera houses and concert halls are the last bastion of natural sound. Acoustic engineer Scott Pfeiffer works for Kierkegaard Associates, a firm that's hired to tune up and improve the sound of auditoriums like Davies Hall in San Francisco.
The whole reason that it's more interesting to listen to concerts inside of a building and in an unamplified, natural way is that in addition to the direct sound that comes out of the instrument or the voice that comes to the audience, you have a whole family of reflected sounds. And the business of making good halls is the business of arranging that set of reflections for all places, all sources on stage, so that they arrive at the audience in a pleasing way.
And the sound must be pleasing for the performer as well. Marcia Janensky sings in the popular a cappella quartet Anonymous Four. They perform and record all over the world in a variety of venues, from grand concert halls to tiny churches.
The actual space that we start with makes a huge difference in terms of the sound that we get, and even in terms of our emotional involvement in the music. If we can hear, for example, when we're singing chant, that the sound is coming back to us in the room, that actually helps us to sing better and helps us to spin out the chant. Of course, every once in a while we end up in a 2,000, 2,600 seat hall, and four people singing medieval music in a hall that big requires sound enhancement. And we've been mic'd with four mics. We've been mic'd with those little butterfly-looking mics on the floor, which actually worked really well. And then there's some places that have just that all-around sound enhancement that they can turn on in the really high-tech new halls. And we've used that as well, and that actually works pretty well.
Sophisticated electronics have finally entered the once sacrosanct precincts of the concert hall and opera house. Most of the time, acoustic engineers like Scott Pfeiffer try to improve the sound of a hall by adding canopies and new reflective surfaces. But now, if they can't fix the hall architecturally, they can fix it electronically. 2 years ago, Kierkegaard Associates designed a sound enhancement system for the New York City Opera.
The idea is that the microphones around stage pick up the sound that is produced on stage, and the speakers in the house play it back as if it had reflected off surfaces that were in the right place. Occasionally the term is used as electronic architecture. The idea is that when the system is on, it is taking the place of fixed walls and fixed constructed elements in an architectural environment.
And the truth is, sometimes these systems sound really good. Last week, I stopped by the Brooklyn Academy of Music, which uses such a system, and heard a bit of a dress rehearsal for a production of Janáček's The Macropolis Case. The sound in the theater was crisp and clear and highly musical. When I asked a member of the production staff if the sound enhancement system was turned on, he told me yes. I honestly had no idea. Anthony Tomasini gave The Macropolis Case a rave review in the New York Times, but he's been a vociferous critic of the introduction of microphones and speakers into concert halls and opera houses.
I felt like it was crossing a line, that the very fact that the majority of the audience was not bothered by it bothered me. One of the great things about classical music is that it always has meant that you're hearing natural sound. When I was a kid, I remember going to the stratosphere of the Metropolitan Opera House for Aida with Leontine Price, having only the vaguest idea of what Aida was about, and not really knowing the music. But I will never forget what it sounded like to have her soft pianissimo high notes just come floating up to the rafters and surround me.
Of course, the only way to illustrate the last point was by playing a recording of Aida. In the interest of full disclosure, all of the interviews in the story were recorded on digital audio tape, even the one that was conducted on the phone and recorded by someone else. These interviews were then edited on my home computer to eliminate ums, uhs, and repeated words, and sometimes rearranged to provide a greater sense of clarity and flow. My narrations were assembled from a multitude of takes, and the entire story was mixed on a Macintosh computer with all sorts of digital bells and whistles. By the time you hear this, the dynamic range of Leontine Price's singing may have been compressed by the transmitter at your local public radio station. Finally, this story is definitely not on Memorex. For Studio 360, I'm Jeff London.